Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Parenting can really do a number on you. The outsized emotions that come with loving and protecting a tiny person can be so overwhelming, you look at yourself occasionally and think, who is this person? Susan Perabot writes about one of those moments in her essay, When Mothers Bully Back. It's read by Ellie Kemper, who stars in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix.
Once, I threw a playground ball at the head of a boy who was repeatedly dunking my young son underwater. Before I threw the ball, I shouted at him to stop, but he continued. I was at the other end of the pool, maybe a 6-second swim away, but my 5-year-old son was gasping and pleading, and the fastest way to make my point was to throw the ball. I played college baseball. I have a pretty good arm. I nailed the older boy in the back of the head, and he cried out, spun around furiously to face me. I'm pretty sure he wasn't expecting to see a mom in an unflattering swimsuit, but there I was. Despite the awkward silence on the pool deck, where family members of both boys sat forward in their lounge chairs, I felt no shame or regret. I felt triumphant. I felt empowered. If I'd had another ball within arm's reach, I might well have thrown it too, for emphasis. A year or so later, my son was the victim of teasing at school. It was garden variety name-calling. Nothing extraordinary, just your generic first-grade flirtation with cruelty. But when the teacher informed me of it, I went internally ballistic. My son was a bit gloomy, though clearly not traumatized. When I asked him about it, he waved me off, seeming more troubled by my concern than by the incident itself. But of course, I was instantly and thoroughly unhinged. A switch flipped, and suddenly I was that crazy woman in the pool again. But where was my trusty playground ball? And how was I supposed to protect my son when I was absent from the scene of the crime? The consensus among family and friends was that I was overreacting. Had I really not anticipated that my child might be picked on every so often? That dunking and name-calling were part of the package? That kids might occasionally be, you know, jerks? Of course I had anticipated this. What I had not anticipated, what I had in fact been utterly unable to anticipate, was how those things would make me feel. This was not the first time that the intense emotions of motherhood had taken me by surprise. For the first several years of my son's life, I had been regularly astonished by moments of unbridled joy, moments so unlike anything I had known that each time I experienced one, his hand curling closed around my index finger, his light-up sneakers flashing at the end of the dark driveway, his bat finally connecting with the ball on the wobbly tee. I felt I was starting life over, stepping out of one life and into another as a brand new person. Now, in the wake of the bullying, I was feeling like a brand new person again. Unfortunately, that brand new person was a lunatic. I didn't want to physically harm my son's bullies. I just wanted to crush their spirits. I wanted them to feel tiny and powerless and stupid. I wanted them to cry sniveling tears in front of a crowd of jeering, joyful classmates. Walking my dog late at night, my conniving obscured by the neighborhood shadows, I concocted and dismissed dozens of outlandish plans, each with the approximate sophistication of a fifth-grade Halloween prank. The main problem was that I simply couldn't figure out the logistics of my vigilanteism. If only I could be in a position to publicly humiliate the bullies. If only I had the kind of job that would make that possible. If I were a barber, I could give them terrible haircuts, setting them up as prime targets for other bullies. If I were a waitress, I could shake chili powder over their hamburgers, causing gagging and drooling, possibly even vomiting. Alas, I was a college professor. Short of mocking the cliched nature of their bullying, four eyes, seriously, is that the best you got, punk? My prospects for retribution were slim. I also understood, even in my addled state, that to intervene might cause my son added humiliation. If I openly retaliated, I could be feeding the bullies a buffet of delicious, irresistible material. The target on my son's back would be seen from space. Baby needs his mom to fight his battles. The thought enraged me even further. Not only was my maternal protection undesired, it was also now a legitimate liability. Going down this rabbit hole and acknowledging the intense satisfaction I got from these little revenge fantasies against seven-year-olds got me thinking about the parameters of acceptable maternal behavior. Surely I was not the first mother to have had these thoughts, but I couldn't recall many instances of people discussing this kind of rage openly. Not actual mothers, and not fictional mothers either. It struck me that, as enlightened as we are about some of the gray areas of human nature, other gray areas seem inherently off limits. We are uncomfortable with mothers who are not easily definable, with good mothers who sometimes think bad thoughts, and even do bad things. In the movies, if a mother is going to be bad, then we want her to be really bad. Texas cheerleader mom bad. Joan Crawford wire hanger bad. Otherwise, we prefer fictional mothers to be gently flawed and efficiently redeemable. We want their mistakes to be caused by misunderstandings, their shortcomings the result of a lack of confidence, like bringing store-bought cookies to the potluck and trying to pass them off as home-baked. In fiction, wackiness is valued above all in the flawed mother. Because pain caused by the wacky mother is not real pain, it's amusing sitcom pain, and as such, does not last beyond the episode and leaves no scars on its victims. I think that essentially the same is true in real life. We are uncomfortable with mothers thinking horrible things, even under horrible circumstances. We don't want them to be cruel unless the cruelty is directed at someone who clearly deserves it. We are unnerved by maternal ugliness and malice and selfishness that can't be entirely justified or, even worse, satisfyingly resolved. We don't want mothers to throw balls at children's heads, but we especially don't want mothers to want to throw a second ball for punishment after the threat has passed. My maternal instinct to protect my child in that swimming pool is forgivable. My maternal instinct for vengeance is not. At all. Except this. My children, my son and his younger sister, love the story of me in the pool. They want to hear it again and again, relishing even the smallest details. What sound did the ball make when it hit the boy's head? Thwack! How far did it ricochet? 10, maybe 12 feet. Did the boy ever try to dunk anyone again? Not on my watch. They laugh. They slap me high fives. They say, "You're crazy!" But they say it like a compliment, like wildly overreacting is a good thing. So maybe it's just a hypothetical mother that we prefer to see exhibiting sound judgment and proper behavior. Maybe it's the idea of the good mother we hold in high regard. But in actuality, in the unflattering swimsuit of our own realities, we, at least as children, are happy to have a mother who loves us so much she will behave like a lunatic on our behalf. My personal lust for revenge against those first grade bullies didn't last long, at least not at that fever pitch. Life and parenthood quickly got more complicated, because that's what life and parenthood do. As is the case with all of our children, the threats my son faced as a tween and teenage boy were nearly impossible to attribute to any particular individuals, and name-calling became the least of my worries. Even dunking, now 10 years past, seems almost quaint. The things that dunk our kids now are impervious to balls, no matter how true our aim. In retrospect, it was lovely to have those obvious villains, those specific names to curse, those clear bullseyes. The dangers now are ones that lurk in the shadows, shapeshifters, moving targets. I have no satisfying fantasies of defeating them. My son is now friends with his old tormentors. At 15, they call each other all sorts of terrible things. They are all bullies, and they are all bullied. In no time, they will be men. In a year, they'll be driving cars. For now, though, they still need me. I drive them to the movies. I pick them up from school in the rain. We get mochas at the Starbucks drive-thru. They're pretty good kids, all of them. And the fact that I once wanted to make them cry makes me feel a little guilty. But not that guilty.
That's Ellie Kemper reading Susan Perabo's essay, When Mothers Bully Back. Here's Ellie.
I love so many things about this essay. I think it's funny and touching and insightful and wise. I am a mother of an almost 2-year-old, and he is the sweetest boy on the planet, not that I'm biased, and whenever I see some little twerp grab a sand pail from him at the sandbox or not accept a toy truck that he's offering them, I want to take the little boy or little girl who is not being as nice to him, and I want to chuck that little boy or girl over the playground fence. So I do connect to the feeling and the desire for vengeance in this essay. I'm not proud of it, but it exists, and that's why I love it.
Thanks again to Ellie for reading this week's essay. You can see her in Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix, which has just been nominated for an Emmy for Best Comedy. We'll catch up with Susan after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
We asked Susan Perabo how people reacted to her modern love piece and whether she got any pushback against the idea of a mom being a bully.
So I don't think there was anybody, at least that said to my face, oh my God, you're crazy, or what were you thinking? You know, I think that most people knowing me took it in the spirit in which it was intended, which is that I did this crazy thing and I'm not proud of it, but I'm also not ashamed of it.
Some people did write to Susan to tell her she shouldn't have done what she did and that throwing the ball might have taught her son the wrong lesson. And she also heard from people who said things like,
my gosh, you know, if she has a good arm and she threw a ball really hard, you know, it could knock the child over, it could injure the child. This was not a ball that could injure a person. I wish that I could include the ball with every copy of the essay so that I could be cleared of some of those charges.
Susan says that she'd still make the same decision to throw the ball today if necessary. But in some ways, her thinking about parenting has changed since that day in the pool.
I think I have a better sense of what battles I need to let my children fight by themselves and what battles I need to be a part of. That dangerous point is when you're unwilling to let them go out and figure out ways to negotiate situations without you, because God knows they're going to have to do that. And so I think that balance is really important to strike. And I think I'm closer than I was 10 years ago.
Well, Susan, I'm so grateful to hear that because, honestly, I still feel like I have a long way to go myself. Susan Perabo, her son is 17 now and is starting to look at colleges, and she teaches creative writing at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Susan's the author of several books, including The Broken Places and The Fall of Lisa Bello. More after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I think we do surprising things, and we feel surprisingly powerful emotions when we're parents. And she unearths that all so beautifully. My experiences with being too emotional as a parent. We're usually on the soccer sidelines of my son's games when he was sort of one of the little kids on the field. And, you know, you really do feel the urge to step out onto that field and do something about it. And you know how inappropriate it is, and you know how yelling at the ref is inappropriate, and yet you still feel yourself starting to go there. And it takes all the restraint in the world to, you know, say to yourself, this is his business. This is for kids, not for adults. But completely, I identified with those emotions.
Next week, actor and rapper Awkwafina, who stars in Ocean's 8 and Crazy Rich Asians.
I almost gave up on dating when a sandwich rejected me. I got a message on OkCupid that said, what's shaking, bacon? And the only profile pictures were of actual sandwiches. Delicious-looking sandwiches, but sandwiches nonetheless.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, Caitlin O'Keefe, and John Parati. Our intern is Louisa Judge. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.